We've probably all been guilty of it. With our good intentions, our well-meaning thoughts, we've offered a platitude. We've said things like, it is what it is. Everything happens for a reason. Tomorrow is another day. Platitudes, these cliches that we use to try to soothe unease. They are good conversation enders because we don't know what to say in response. These statements might have some element of truth in them, but they're so overused that they've lost their meaning. Our Philippians text is full of platitudes. Stand firm in the Lord. Rejoice in the Lord always. Do not be anxious about anything. The peace of God, which surpasses all understanding, will guard your hearts and your minds in Christ Jesus. Whatever is true, whatever is honorable, think on these things. We have plastered these phrases on t-shirts and wall art, on stickers and pillows and coffee mugs. They're everywhere. What we have to realize is that these sayings have done some damage. As Debbie Thomas notes, telling someone who struggles with clinical depression to rejoice always is cruel. So is telling someone in the throes of a panic attack to just stop feeling anxious. Don't worry. She says, too often, Christians demand of each other a Pollyanna-ish cheerfulness that refuses to look the complexities of real life in the face, as if our faith, and by extension, our God, is too fragile to handle life's dark side. When we use platitudes, they can hurt us and other people. One danger of platitudes is that they can lead us to shut down, to stop thinking or acting. They're used to sum up everything and serve as a blanket answer, an end to a conversation instead of a beginning. When Paul wrote to the Philippians, I don't think he intended to offer them a list of platitudes. I think he wanted them to reflect, to learn to do the hard work of life together. In fact, Paul wrote from prison, so all was not well where he was. He was not an out-of-touch optimist, giving his friends a list of trite sayings. He was inviting them into conversation. And yet here we are with what have become platitudes. What if we think about these phrases and instructions as an invitation to something deeper, a challenge rather than a trite answer? Early in the text, we read the admonition to stand firm. This instruction has been used to push us toward a rigid posture of holding on to what we believe is right and either condemning or trying to convince everyone else who we believe is wrong. Maybe the text is getting at the idea of posture. How do we posture ourselves toward each other and all others? What is it we stand firm for? Is it being right? Is it thinking everyone should think and act and be like us? What if we stand firm for unity and solidarity, for welcome and radical hospitality? What if we stand firm for everyone having equal footing as we stand with and for each other? The text goes on to say, let your gentleness be known to everyone. What if we stand firm in gentleness? Gentleness is sometimes seen as weakness. It actually requires great strength. Gentleness is a posture of humility, of openness and kindness. It's making space for all, asking questions instead of standing firm on answers. This text gets at the idea of unity, where gentleness leads us to solidarity. A couple of weeks ago, I had the opportunity to attend the 40th anniversary celebration of Baptist Women in Ministry. BWIM, as it's called for short, exists to support and advocate for women in ministry and leadership. The anniversary gathering was a wonderful time of hearing stories of how BWIM began and celebrating where it is now. It was also a challenging time of recognizing that there is more work to do. During the gathering, the leadership of BWIM noted how this movement within Baptist life has mostly benefited white women. It is our stories that have been told and centered, while we have overlooked the stories of others. We heard from Reverend Alicia Zorzoli sharing her experiences as a Latina pastor and the contrast in her work in South America versus here in the United States. We listened to Reverend Dr. Carolyn L. Gordon, an African-American pastor and professor, sharing the experiences of Black women in ministry. In recounting these stories, Reverend Dr. Gordon said, "We were always with you, white women, in the struggles for ministry, but we were sure you were not always with us." In a place where we were celebrating the work of women and appreciating how we felt heard and seen by each other, it was hard to hear her words. And they were words we so desperately needed to hear. Reverend Zorzoli and Reverend Dr. Gordon went on to be part of a panel discussion. And one of the questions they were asked was, whose voices are not being heard? This panel listed several examples, like our Asian siblings, our Indigenous siblings, our siblings with disabilities, our LGBTQ siblings, our younger siblings, and more. These women made all of us stop and think. I think the church needs to ask these questions too. If we are to stand firm in gentleness, to stand firm in welcome and solidarity, then we have to ask ourselves, whose voices are we missing? Whose stories are not being heard or told? Whose voices have we missed either by accident, an honest lack of paying attention or realizing? And whose stories have we missed by willfully ignoring voices we don't want to hear? Standing firm in gentleness, in welcome, and in unity is a journey that we are ever on. It's not a to-do list where we can check off all the items and be finished. It is ongoing work, a posture, not a platitude. In 1952, Norman Vincent Peale published his famous self-help book, The Power of Positive Thinking. Though it received criticism from scholars and health experts, it was wildly popular with the general public and spent 186 weeks on the New York Times bestsellers list. With personal anecdotes, affirmations, and techniques, the book aimed to help people achieve a permanent optimistic attitude. One of its instructions is to think a positive thought to drown out a negative thought. Norman Vincent Peale was a pastor, so maybe he had some of our sayings from Philippians in mind when he wrote his book. After all, verse 8 of our text sounds a lot like the power of positive thinking. Whatever is true, whatever is honorable, whatever is just, if there is any excellence, and if there is anything worthy of praise, think about these things. This can sound lofty and unrealistic, a way to distract ourselves from the difficulties around and within us. It can feel like we're ignoring the harshness and hardness of life. And as a platitude, that might be exactly what it has us do. We're called to think more deeply. Setting our minds on these things is not a distraction, not a denial of the difficult. Setting our minds on these things, things like truth and justice, is a call to keep paying attention, to turn ourselves, posture ourselves toward these things, to stand firm in our resolve to listen to truth from wherever it may be found, to believe those whose voices have been silenced or ignored for too long. Thinking on these things is not passive, not a way to distract ourselves while we wait for things to get better. Our Isaiah text talks about waiting. We read of this beautiful scene of a feast for all people, of God swallowing up death forever and wiping away the tears from all faces. It will be said on that day, "See, this is our God. We have waited for God. This is the one for whom we have waited." I think about all the ways we see and experience death around us. The physical death of our loved ones, the death of hopes and dreams, the death of plans and purpose, the death of what we hold dear. I think about the ways we as humans enact death on others, from war and violence to racism and sexism and ableism and ageism and more, from words of hate, words that belittle and disparage others, to our apathy and indifference, from our one-on-one acts of cruelty and carelessness to our participation in systems and structures of oppression. There's so much death. God's swallowing up death forever requires something of us. Instead of asking why God allows so much injustice in the world, we need to ask why we do. What if we think about waiting on God, not as passively sitting back, waiting around, not doing anything? What if it's more like waiting tables, where we're active and engaged, doing the work of waiting, of paying attention? As we think about the things we believe God calls us to do, we think of how Micah 6:8, which has also been used as a platitude at times, how it asks, what does God require of us? How do we wait on God but to do justly, to love mercy, and to walk humbly? That sounds a lot like what we've read in Philippians. Whatever is true and just and noble, standing firm in gentleness and in thinking on these things, because our thinking on these things is not passive. It is a thinking that leads to doing. It is a posture, not a platitude. We can't neglect maybe the biggest platitude of all in our text. Rejoice in the Lord always. Again, I will say, rejoice. It sounds pretty lofty. And like any good platitude, how do you argue with it? It oozes with positivity and optimism, a call to find the best in every situation, to give thanks and be joyful no matter what. In the movie Inside Out, we meet a young girl named Riley. All of her emotions are personified, so we have an inside look at what's going on in her brain. Joy is the main character, the main emotion out of the five that live inside the mind of Riley. Joy appears to be happy all the time and full of energy. Now, sadness is another of the emotions in Riley's mind, and joy has absolutely no use for sadness. She tries to distract sadness and keep her from affecting Riley's mood or memories. Joy always sees the good in everything, which causes her to be somewhat oblivious to the sad aspects of things. She's determined to push aside feelings of anger or sadness and to think positively instead. Joy embodies the way "rejoice in the Lord always" has often been used. It's been an admonition to push aside other feelings and realities, to focus on the positive. Once again, we need to look deeper. If we think about standing firm in joy, there has to be more to it than toxic positivity or obliviousness. In her book, This Here Flesh, Cole Arthur Riley notes, "When people demand joy always, it makes the world seem incompatible with those of us whose happiest days are still anguished." She goes on to say, "There's so much that is worthy of lament, of rage. Joy doesn't preclude these emotional habits. It invites them. Joy situates every emotion within itself. It grounds them so that one isn't overindulged while the others lie starving. Joy doesn't replace any emotion. It holds them all and keeps any one of them from swallowing us whole. Society has failed to understand this. When it tells us to find joy in suffering, it's telling us to let it go, to move on, to smile through it. But joy says, hold on to your sorrow. It can rest safely here. Standing firm in gentleness, in welcome and solidarity, standing firm in thinking on these things, thinking that leads to doing the work of swallowing up death in all its forms, standing firm in joy. These are not platitudes, but postures, ways of being in the world. Reverend Lindsay Popperson is a United Church of Christ minister in Boston. This past week, she held vigil outside the synagogue that meets in a church in her neighborhood. Her presence and the presence of two other ministers who were able to join her at the last minute meant that the Jews gathered inside could pray and weep and sing, knowing someone else was keeping an eye out for any threats. Thankfully, there were none on that night. Pastor Lindsay said, "I wish I could do this always for each of you. Hold vigil while you gather with the ones who give you strength and peace. I wish I could do it for the whole world, but I can't. So I do it for these folks. I did it because I've been invited to do it year after year by folks who know and trust me. I did it because it's what my soul needed, because solidarity saves my soul too and allows me to pray. And I did it because my friends and neighbors were inside and I need them to survive. I did it because Christianity has played a leading role in anti-Semitism and colonialism, and so part of my work as a minister is working to repair that." She says, "I post this not to be self-congratulatory. I get it wrong far more often than I get it right, but I want to show folks the possibilities of what love and solidarity and community look like. And I've been guided most this week by Jews who are being really beautifully, humbly nuanced in their responses to the violence, who see the humanity of Palestinians, who recognize the violence of decades of siege and occupation on Palestine, who refuse to be constricted by false binaries, who believe there is enough justice and peace and food and water and electricity to go around. May we too stand firm in solidarity, in gentleness, in listening and caring and swallowing up death in all its forms. May we move past platitudes and take on these postures. Amen.